Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vassilash, episode 362 for January 27 of 2017. Chevy Colorado takes the high road. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Back in the studio.
Yes. Last week, ostensibly in Detroit at the auto show.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot noisier than it is now.
I know. I like being in the studio.
Yeah, it's very, very much better.
And we got to let everybody know we got Chris Pockert back in the house.
Thanks for having me. Always great to be here.
Yeah, Chris, always good having you here, too. And, of course, you're being with CNET and doing all great things with them.
Yep, all the roadshow by CNET, great stuff.
And I saw out in the parking lot a Focus RS that you're driving.
It's very subtle. It just arrived today, but it's perfect for this kind of wintry mixed weather that we've got going to have all-wheel drive and having all that power is a lot of fun.
Yeah, maybe we'll talk more about it later in the show because right now we got to talk about our special guest, and the truck she brought in the studio. We've got Anita Burke. She's the chief engineer for, all the compact trucks at
GM. All mid-sized pickup trucks.
All mid-sized pickup trucks. But in the studio right now, we've got the Chevrolet Colorado ZR2. And you got to tell us about this truck. I mean, the way I'm describing it is, this is GM's answer or Chevy's answer to the Ford Raptor. I know they're not an apples to apples, but that's kind of the segment you're going after, isn't it?
It's really a great addition to our already very strong midsize truck family. As you know, we came back into the segment in the 15 model year with the Colorado and really set the bar for all midsize trucks. We feel with the introduction of the ZR2, it's really going to reset the expectations for the off-road with this performance variant.
So the Colorado, when you came out with it, you wanted to make a truck that would have truck capability and consumer comforts. Right?
Absolutely, because one unique aspect of a mid-size truck customer is they drive them every day. They use them for work and play, as well as everyday driving experience. Mm-hmm. So the comfort features are very critical to them. Fuel economy is very critical to them, but it is a pickup truck. They want the versatility of that box, as well as the capabilities such as payload and towing. And then we bring on the ZR2 that brings in the off-road characteristics. That's another key truck aspect. Mm-hmm.
And you were able to do that very successfully without stepping on the toes of the Silverado to bring in this midsize class that a lot of people thought was dead. There wasn't a lot of activity in small trucks, and I don't know if it's because people weren't investing in them and creating new reasons to go buy them, or if it's just because full-size trucks have gotten so big. But can you talk a little bit about the success you've had so far?
There's very critical aspects of why this truck has been successful and why we really saw this as a very great opportunity for General Motors. The segment has been, quite frankly, before we came into it, kind of abandoned, orphaned. There wasn't a lot of change.
Not by Toyota. Toyota, they were serious about that segment, but maybe the only one.
They were. And there was not a lot of offerings that were appealing to the customers at that time. There's not a lot of choice. And at the time, 12.5 million customers were still on the road driving midsize pickup trucks, some of them looking for an alternative choice that they did not see. General Motors was, when we brought this in, was the only automaker, OE, that really has a truck for every customer with our heavy-duty, our light-duty full-size, and then the midsize truck. Because not every customer needs the full-size capability or size. They're looking for something that parks in their garage, has the maneuverability for city as well as urban life, and brings home that capability with the features in it, but not to the grand scale of a full size. And that really did appeal to the customer, and we've seen that in the industry. Since we've entered into this industry, back into the segment, roughly in the 2014 calendar year, segment size was mid-250,000 volume. We've now seen over a 75% growth. We're upwards of 450,000 for 16 calendar year. So we've really seen this segment grow since we brought the Colorado into it in 2015 model year.
Yeah. Being the chief engineer since day one, you must be a real hero around there.
You know, it's truly been a labor of love. I've been very, very fortunate that I've been assigned to this segment since day one when General Motors made the decision to re-enter the segment with it. So it's been a labor of love, and it's been a great opportunity to really provide to the customer a truck that they not only expect, but they deserve.
So between the Colorado and the Canyon, sales were, what, about 140,000 last year?
Right along those lines,
like
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now you got the ZR2, this monster off-road capability truck. Is that going to increase sales? Is it going to shift sales? What do you think it's going to do?
I am highly confident that we are going to sell a lot of these vehicles.
And they're going to come out of, probably not Raptor, I should have mentioned the Toyota Tacoma TRD.
The TRD Pro is a key off-road vehicle that's in this segment. Mm-hmm. We expect that there will be customers choosing between those two, and they have this as a very strong choice. One thing that's going to we really focused in on, just as we did with the parent truck, the base truck, is the fact that we want to make sure the everyday driving experience is still exceptional. That's what this customer is going to experience. They can go off-road, they can go two-tracking, they can go rock climbing all weekend long, jump in that truck after getting off the trail, and have a comfort ride home to their house. That was, we did not want to compromise. We wanted to give them all that experience, the on-road performance as well as the off-road. And I think we've delivered it with this truck.
So let me ask you something. For people who are not necessarily savvy with all of the nomenclature, so you offer a Z71 mm-hmm. and a ZR2. What's the difference between the Z71 and the ZR2?
What the ZR2 is bringing forth is really a true additional variant to the portfolio. It brings in unprecedented off-road performance to it, and it's got key technology that doesn't exist on the Z71, including class segment rear, front and rear electronic differential lockers. We have the unique suspension. It's a lifted variant. It's 2 inches higher. It's 3.5 inches wider. It's got unique front bumpers and rear bumpers that give off-road clearancing for obstacles off-road. So those characteristics are not part of the Z71 trim level.
So this is the real deal, and the other one's sort of the
Z71 is absolutely an off-road capable vehicle, but this is a variant that brings it up a level.
What I wanted to ask you is it true that this was already part of the plans for Colorado the whole time, that you wanted to do a ZR2, something that was this fully realized and fully baked? Or is it something that, because you've had the success with this model line that you've had, that you now have the ability to kind of ratchet things up a little bit?
Those of us who were working the program really on absolutely saw this as an opportunity. We had the vision that we knew that this was absolutely a possibility. And as we developed the foundation, the architecture that exists under the 15 and 16 model year vehicles, we planned accordingly as much as possible to break this one possible. Obviously, there's things that are unique and different as we lifted it, made it wider, that are now unique and specific to this. But the vision and the opportunity existed since day one. We saw that this was going to be a very strong segment if we delivered what the customer was asking us to do, both in the base trucks in 15 and 16, then, of course, this off-road ZR2 is all the better for the customer.
So let's get into some of the specifics of what you did. And I got to add that I got a chance to ride in the truck. I haven't had a chance to drive it yet, but I got a chance to ride in it because you did a media thing at the LA Auto
Show. Yes, we did.
I was knocked out by the climbing abilities, the handling abilities, how this thing smoothed out the big jumps. So let's just start with the suspension. Clearly, you didn't just raise this thing. You made some serious changes. Let's start with the suspension and talk about what you did there.
One of the key aspects of it, as I mentioned, it's lifted 2 inches from its base parent, Colorado. And what we've brought forth into this is a partnership with the Multimatic Dynamic Suspension Spool Valve Damper System. And that's what we're utilizing on this. And that really brings forth a precision valving that gives us the ability to tune and deliver both that on-road performance of everyday driving as well as the capability to have off-road rock crawling, great extreme suspension tuning for rebound and compression that you'd experience off-road, as well as the suspension has a great thermal management characteristic where it doesn't fade or overheat. So therefore,
the shocks or the dampers.
The shocks, the dampers. Yes, sorry, the dampers as well. That way, when you're running, desert running, it delivers great performance and not overheat.
And greater suspension travel as well.
Absolutely. So we've got increased suspension travel, upwards of an inch to 2 inches greater than what you'd have on, for example, the Z71.
So you mentioned Multimatic as the shock provider. They're not traditionally in the off-road world at all.
They are not. This is the first time they're partnering with somebody and doing an off-road variant, correct?
And how did that come to be? Did they come to you and say, we'd really like to try something? Or did you put out, you know, a proposal saying we need these sort of parameters and who can deliver?
You know, we saw this as an opportunity. They have a relationship with General Motors. They did the Camaro Z28 performance. So they had a relationship and a performance with us in the past. And we saw this as an opportunity to bring them in to this variant and bring that unique characteristics for all those reasons of wide range of performance they could bring into this variant as well.
And we shouldn't dive too deeply into the shocks because we could spend a whole show on that. But explain a little bit, because if you look at the damper itself, it looks a little bit different, but it's the inner workings that are unlike anything else on the market.
It is. It's the position sensors and the spool valve technology that exists within these dampers that's able to deliver something unique that's not available within the traditional disc shock damping of the typical systems that we have today. So what that allows us to do is a wider range of force versus velocity tuning characteristics, much more availability. You typically have two, for example, in a traditional disc type. You have 6 to 4 in this. So that allows that wide range of tuning capability to cover all the bases that we want to bring this truck through.
So basically you have 3 valves in each damper, and 2 are for normal-ish driving, and then the 3rd kicks in when you're really out there climbing the rocks.
Correct, which gets you into being able to handle that extreme rebound and compression that you experience on rock crawling.
And does it know itself? I mean, does it?
It does.
So nobody's...
Yep. Position sensors technology is how it works. Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there any user adjustability in the suspension, if you know different shock pickup points or anything like that?
From the shock tuning, what we have is we've got many different tuning valves, but we also have an off-road mode that works with our traction control. And what that is many, many different series of calibrations that use our chassis controls as well as our throttle and engine calibrations for covering also those different characteristics of what you're going to bring the truck through.
But, and these Multimatic shocks, front and rear?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there's no mechanical, like, you know, take the wheel off and...
Nope.
Nope. It's all fully baked.
Fully integrated.
Okay.
Fully
so
integrated.
We touched on the suspension. You got these Multimatic shocks. We should point out Multimatic's huge racing background. In fact, they're the guys building the Ford GT, although the Ford
Formula
GT does not have these shocks on it.
Not.
And Formula One,
Formula One is where they're very
Formula
well
One.
Known. Yes.
Oh my God, those things are like I didn't know that you could make dampers as small as they make
mm-hmm.
for Formula One. But let's go up. You touched on the drivetrain a little bit. Talk about the different diffs that you've got in there.
So we have class exclusive. We've got front and rear electronic rocking differentials, which really bring the capability for those off road. Fun scenarios that you can bring this wherever you want it to do. So we are exclusive with that. And
is there a center diff too?
It's...
I mean, you've got front and rear differentials, right?
Correct.
Okay, I guess maybe I'm...
And locking, you could lock the front axle and you could lock the rear. What you experienced in LA, for example,
mm-hmm.
was when you've got, you know, two wheels spinning, lock the rear axle and you can climb further. You get 3 locking. You could lock that front, and you can climb over most anything.
What about what's under the hood?
So what's under the hood is we continue to offer our high-feature V6 as well as our Duramax diesel that exists in the parent ones. Those bring home the high-feature V6 is fitted with our 8-speed transmission, and the diesel's coming with the 6-speed.
Diesel buyers tend to be a little bit more hardcore about their trucks. You know, they're not they're not necessarily casual. They're committed enthusiasts. They know what they want. They want the torque. They want, you know, that type of power delivery and fuel economy. Something like this seems like it'd be, you know, maybe a little bit more tailor-made for a diesel. Do you have any projections that you could share about what you expect gas versus diesel?
I think each engine's going to, for those items you just described, are going to appeal to both our customers. The 369 foot-pounds of torque that diesel brings is going to be definitely appealing to those looking for that low-end torque that diesel brings home. The gas engine will be probably more appealing to those who are doing the fast-running, desert-type running, as well as everyday performance. So each delivers exceptional performance in all the characteristics. We've evaluated it in many, many different scenarios, and both engines perform exceptionally well.
You mentioned that you raised it by 2 inches.
Correct.
You also widened the track by 3.5 inches. Why did you do that?
Correct. Well, we wanted to ensure that we were covering, from a wheelbase standpoint, all the obstacles. So we're still very much narrow. We're still about 12 inches narrower than mirror-to-mirror, for example, than a full-size truck, which allows you to access many different areas that a full-size truck, from a size standpoint, wouldn't do it. But we wanted to make sure we had a great footprint for those off-road obstacles and stance and stability as you took adventures in it.
So make it more planted.
Mm-hmm.
Can you?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you raised a good point. This is significantly narrower than a Ford Raptor.
About 12 inches, correct.
So you can sneak your way through box canyons and things like that off-road more easily.
Absolutely. With this truck being about 12 inches narrower and about 500 pounds lighter, the nimbleness and the maneuverability you'll be able to see. You'll be able to travel with a mid-sized truck to many different areas that you wouldn't be able to access with a full-size truck.
Yeah. Hey, hold your question.
Sure.
Think about it. Don't forget it. Don't forget it, Chris, because we're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going
to
be right back.
Repeat yourself.
Maybe he is coming back. Maybe he's not. But we are back. And, Chris, I cut you off, so you remember your question?
I do, actually. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the tire choice. These are 31s, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, 17-inch, 31-inch tire.
Why did you decide to go with that tire as opposed to potentially something a little bit larger?
You know, You'll see when you have an opportunity to drive it and experience it. We are very confident with our experience that this tire delivers those characteristics, as I said, that is really appealing to the customer from what we've seen. We wanted to ensure we give the everyday great ride and handling experience as well as that off-road capability. And we've proven that this truck gives us just that, and it's the right choice.
You know, one thing I think we should mention, this truck is not available right now.
It is not. It's coming to your dealers in spring of 2017, so very soon you'll be able to see it in your dealerships.
Mm-hmm. So you can't talk price yet or anything like that?
Closer to launch, we'll be able to share both fuel economy as well as pricing.
Okay.
There's been a remarkable tendency in the industry that there doesn't seem to be ceiling on what you can charge for pickup trucks, certainly in the full-size market, but now we're starting to see people willing to spend a little bit more to get more performance in compact and mid-sized trucks. So is this the highest you can go with this type of vehicle? I mean,
we're very attuned to the fact that we want to be cost sensitive to the customer, and cost of ownership is very critical, especially to a mid-sized truck customer. So we're very cognizant of that, and we always want to make an offering that's aligned with the segment and very competitive to the segment.
So what's a Toyota Tacoma TRD Pro cost?
I believe they're mid-40s,
okay.
I believe.
So I got to believe cost competitive, you're going to be in that ballpark.
That's where Toyota sits today, and we'll give you our pricing as we get closer to launch.
Now you're, because you're the mid-sized truck person, so you're also Canyon.
I am.
So are there significant differences between a Colorado and a Canyon? And I mean, not... Obviously, that's different.
Yeah, obviously the ZR2 is specific to Chevrolet and the Colorado. The Canyon, what it offers is fundamentally the same architecture, and again, the ZR2 builds off of that same architecture. But the Canyon brings more of the GMC refinement and characteristic to it. It offers such soft touch materials inside, real aluminum on the steering wheel and the IP, different seat materials. Those type of characteristics that are really in tune to what the GMC customer is looking for.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got it.
Go ahead. I keep stepping on you here.
Yeah.
We see a GMC version of this down the road if there's enough demand?
The ZR2 is really belongs in the Chevrolet Colorado family.
Okay, we got a bunch of questions coming in from the audience here. Don Bishaw wants to know, are we going to see a tire-smoking Colorado or Canyon? Maybe with a 464-horsepower Cadillac V6 and all-wheel drive.
I think what he'll be very impressed with is the experience with our diesel Duramax with that 369 foot-pounds of torque. It can do that justice to those tires, I'll tell you that.
Okay. Jim wants to know, on the Colorado, what's the range of buyers, the age range of buyers? And he wants to know, did you get any surprises about who's buying it and who are you conquesting from?
From a range standpoint, we're seeing a broad range of made. This is appealing to those in their mid-30s. We're seeing a drive down to those in their 20s as well, upwards into the mid-50s, right? It crosses a broad range of it because of its size and maneuverability and versatility. What we're seeing is, as I mentioned earlier, for the longest time, there was a lot of customers that weren't satisfied with their offerings, and they were abandoning their desire for a pickup and going into passenger cars or crossovers. They were giving up their desire to have that box. When we re-entered in it, we saw that they came back. We've seen a growth not only in the industry, but we've seen that there's growth from full-size truck customers who had gone up a level, went to something bigger than they really needed, came to us, as well as those who went to passengers and crossover cars that now can come back and enjoy those same features and fundamentals, but with a pickup capability.
So for obvious reasons, you drive one of these.
Every day.
So when you go into the parking lot and you see your vehicle and then you see a Silverado, do you go, wow, that Silverado's big?
You know, I do, only because I really enjoy a truck. I've driven trucks since the late 90s. It's been my vehicle of choice, not only because I enjoy working with them, but I enjoy I'm 5'2", so I'm not the tallest person, but I enjoy the seating position and the command presence of how I can execute. I enjoy pickups because of their versatility. So a midsize really is appealing to me. I enjoy parking in my garage. I am a little bit of an adventurist. I enjoy going to many different cities and both urban and city. So I like that I could bring and park and access anywhere with this size truck.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a range of accessories beyond this? I mean, it seems like this really opens up the field for lighting options, roll bars, graphics packages, et cetera.
There is. And as we launched with the Colorado, we really enjoy our accessories, and they really bring our vehicles to another level. One thing that is available with this that you've probably seen at the auto show as well is the pickup box spare tire positioning. That is an accessory that is available at launch with this that I think is going to be very appealing to many people as well.
Another audience question here. Chuck Grenchy wants to know, he says, I know you can't comment on future product, but can you comment on whether smaller pickup sizes were explored before deciding on the midsize Colorado?
When we decided on the size of this one, it was a balance of what the customer was looking for, and that was ensuring that it could deliver the capability that was expected from a truck in a package that was maneuverable and parkable. And still gave that right balance. We don't want to compromise, and we feel that this size delivered just that.
And let's see, Bob D's got a very interesting question. He says, why is the diesel engine not offered on the extended cab for retail customers? Fleet buyers can get that configuration. So it seems this is a marketing decision rather than a technical issue.
It is available on our fleet customers. That is an option that they choose to do. We are very attuned to what our customers want. And there is not a strong customer demand from a retail perspective for that configuration. They are asking for the crew cab in that diesel configuration.
Bud wants to know, when are we going to see a Baja version?
You never know. We're always looking for the next
good
opportunity.
Question, Bob.
Good question.
Alabama says, looks like the lower aero plastic cladding has been removed. Is that standard to this model? He says he's read many complaints that the cladding drastically reduces clearance.
So the ZR2 does not have the air dam that is standard on our base Colorado. So I believe that's what he's referring to. Mm-hmm. It does not come with it.
Yeah. You mentioned that earlier. Yep. Different bumpers, front and rear, better clearance.
That's correct. As we lifted it, we also then designed the front bumper and the rear bumper to ensure better access for the off-road obstacles.
And you had to protect the underbody a little bit, too, right?
We did, so that you could see on the front that we have an integrated shield to that bumper, as well as we have plates underneath protecting the truck.
Do you have anything different on the interior of the vehicle?
We have the technology differences where we'll have the locker switches and the off-road mode that's integrated into our switch. So those are the key characteristics. But fundamentally, the interior, still, you'll see the ZR2 emblems, but it's fundamentally...
Still plush.
Exactly. You still have the same pleasurable experience on the interior that you get with the Foundation Colorado.
Uh-huh. Hey, I'm curious, going back to those skid plates, do you know if you pick up any aerodynamic benefits with those?
They are there for functional reasons from an off-road perspective.
Yeah.
Aero, I couldn't
comment. I'm just
curious.
Yeah.
It's like they're not there from an aero enabler. Right. Obviously, we want things smooth and flowing around the vehicle, but they're there from a functional aspect for those off-road experiences.
Well, here we got a question from somebody called Tex ZR2. He wants to know, or she wants to know, any chance for a manual transmission?
At this time, there's no plan for that.
Mm-hmm. And Wright Knight says, Chevrolet needs to bring out a new Blazer on this platform as a true midsize SUV to compete with Jeep.
Well, thanks for that insight. You never know.
I like that idea, actually.
So,
well, there is a Trailblazer still overseas, right?
There is. We do have a Trailblazer for our global locations. That's correct.
Now, you're also chief engineer of the Global Colorado?
Yes, for the future global programs, I am responsible for both a global Chevrolet Colorado as well as the Chevrolet Trailblazer that's produced in our Brazil and Thailand facilities.
Mm-hmm. We just got a phone call here, too. Carmen, let's bring that in.
This is Clem Zarofsky from Delbon, Pennsylvania. My question is on the Multimatic shocks. Are they an electronic shock like used on the Corvette, or is it strictly a mechanical device? Thank you very much.
They are mechanical. That is correct.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about these. These are not MagnaRide shocks
correct.
Or anything like that. They're not electronically adjusted valves, purely mechanical.
That is correct.
Very interesting.
Great technology that really is going to deliver just an exceptional, I can't say enough about. It's been a fantastic partnership, and the ability that they deliver to this truck to cross such a broad range of ride and handling, it really brings this truck to another level.
So where did you test this truck?
We tested it all over. So we have a Yuma Proving Grounds in Arizona where we built and utilized some of the natural essences around that Proving Grounds. We brought off-road courses into that, developed it around there. We've tested it at over a half a dozen around the country, including the Michigan Silver Lake Sand Dunes, Badlands in Indiana, and, of course, some key, very well-known parks such as Moab and Rubicon. We've brought this truck through with great success.
So when you're going through the Rubicon, did you see those other guys there? They were driving that other vehicle that has four letters. And did you see any of those guys?
You know, I'm sure they were there.
Yeah.
It's a very popular place for many different off-roaders that enjoy that experience.
Is this still usable as a truck, payload-wise, towing-wise?
It is. So you still could carry 1,100 pounds of payload and tow 5,000 pounds. So it's still maintained its very capable essence of what a pickup truck does. We wanted to ensure that those who are going to drive it every day and want to use it for that capability, you could still tow, you could still carry payload in that box.
Well, Anita Burke, thanks so much for coming in. We love having the truck in the studio, too. I know all of us are going to chomp at the bit to get the chance to drive it. But I don't want to drive it in my normal everyday commute because you guys spoiled me with that presentation in L.A. I got to tell you, you've got to find super steep hills, and you got to get going fast enough to get this thing airborne off the ground because you cannot believe how smoothly it lands. I mean, I thought, oh boy, here we go. I'm going to throw up or I'm going to break my hip, and I could not believe how smoothly we landed. It was pretty good.
Yep, that's the suspension and those dampers that help us deliver that performance. It's a great foundation of a truck, and this extra technology that we brought to it is going to knock everyone's socks off.
Real good. Thanks again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break here. We're going to be back. We're going to be talking about things that have been going on in the industry this week. And boy, there's plenty of good stuff to talk about.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Okay, we're back, and this is the part of the program coming out of the midway break where it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so we're going to do something a little bit different here today. Uh-oh. Okay, now we have Chris here. I'm sure he's going to come up with the answer to this one.
Oh, dear. Keeping us on our toes.
So this has got a little history to it. It's got a little design to it, but there are numbers involved. So this isn't a pure data thing. It's a point in time, which I found to be very interesting. So, Carmen, please bring up the first slide. So we're talking about the year 1971.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so, as you know, that they do a very interesting job on these slides, and so there's meaning there.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so 1971, and the next slide is the first vehicle to be displayed
at the Louvre.
Now realize the famous Parisian Art Museum.
It should be your car.
Well, it should be a Citroën DS, but 1971, it had been out for, a couple of decades already.
Was the very first vehicle ever to be shown there.
Now, this is the Impey pyramid.
Right, on the outside there.
And he was he's Chinese, right? But he's considered sort of an American
It has nothing to do with that.
Okay.
So there's...
Was it a new vehicle? Can we... Was it new that year, or was it a...
It had just come out.
Oh. 1970.
So the first was model year 70.
First was model year 70. Interesting. And I'm going to guess it's an American car, and I'm going to guess it was the Chevrolet Vega.
Chris, this is the design museum. So I just
Vega would not be what
Or what McElroy just said, right?
I have no idea.
And I mean, I was stunned when I discovered this. I was very surprised. And
I'm wondering,
certain enmity between these two. Well, I'm giving it away a little bit here.
Oh. Give it away.
All right. So Carmen,
I said Vega. I need
Carmen,
all the clues.
Carmen, bring up the answer.
I'm gonna see something really. Yeah.
Isn't that surprising?
Yeah.
That is surprising.
But you got to remember, it's the 1970 Range Rover.
Yeah.
First generation. Mm-hmm. Two-door. Yep. Look at that. A big SUV that's only a two-door. Yeah. You never see that.
And that's where it all started.
No. Yeah. And all the two-doors, the values of those vehicles are now going through the roof.
But why would you have that in an art museum?
Well, that was actually considered quite a radical design when it came. We look at it today and we go, it's an old 71 Range Rover. For the day, that was considered quite avant-garde. They had that sort of castle gables. If you can bring the picture back up, those castle gables at the end of, on the left and right-hand side of the hood. Mm-hmm. Note, too, if we can get that picture back up, how thin all the pillars are in that almost floating-like roof design.
There we go.
How thin it is.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see that anymore. Also, interesting, I didn't pick up on that until we brought the picture back up. Look how the rear-view mirrors are out at the end of the fenders,
like
not up
Japanese
against the
car.
Door. Very Japanese, and that was done away with because of safety standards. They would spear pedestrians. But for the day, and I'm trying to remember the name of the designer who did that. I want to say it was a Swedish guy who did it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I'm blanking out on the name, but that was considered quite avant-garde design for its day.
See, I would have been with you guys. I would have thought that it would have been a Citroën or a...
That's
not a Vega though.
No, but
you said 70, and that's what popped into my
mind. If we were going something, American, I would have picked some like big vulgar coupe, some sort of Lincoln Mark whatever.
Uh-huh.
Just because it would contrast so markedly with what they're used to there, it would just be
right.
A sensation.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, that also would have been rather large for the Parisian boulevards there. So.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so that was our numbers were involved first.
I love that you brought that up, Gary, and I didn't realize a two-door full-size SUV. Be interesting to see if there'd be any market demand for something like that today.
Well, Land Rover still has the Range Rover Evoque in a two-door. And it's probably like one out of every 30 units that they build. I mean, it's nothing.
But it's a much smaller vehicle.
It's much smaller, right. But I just think in general there's not that market for those things. I mean, we used to have two-door everything. I mean, you used to be able to get a two-door Pathfinder. Can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You used to get a 4Runner. Can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, at some point, there'll be every car company will have so many different variants of crossovers that they'll need to just have two doors.
That's right.
Because, you know, it'll just be something different for them. So
convertibles, like
Cross Cabriolet, or what was the
Murano Cross Cabriolet?
Yeah. But there was somebody else.
Land Rover has one right now.
Yeah, yeah.
A Range Rover Evoque.
Right.
Cool stuff.
Weird world.
Okay, Gary, you made a list of things.
All right,
do we
got to
talk about?
All right,
about?
So Ford this week. Okay. They came out with Omnicraft brand, first new brand for parts in 50 years, right? And so this you can go drive in your local Ford dealer in your Land Rover, presumably. Maybe not, but...
Or your Chevy ZR2.
Your Chevy ZR2 at some point, and they're going to have parts for it.
Yeah, it's an interesting play, because I think a lot of automakers have sort of gotten away from that sort of thing. But... I think there'll be general basic parts like oil filters and that sort of thing.
But what are they doing here? I'm glad you brought this up, you know, because they've had the Motorcraft brand forever. You said 50 years or whatever?
50 years since they've come up with the new...
And so now Omnicraft, Omni being, hey, we can service
everybody,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there has been a move by automakers to get their dealers into the quick oil change business, many times with a little standalone building outside the dealership, so that people driving by disassociate it with the dealership because they know they're going to get raked over the coals cost-wise. And that's been pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helped, you know, pay for some back-end bills for the dealerships. But why is the Ford Motor Company encouraging its dealers to service cars that are not Fords? What do you guys think is the strategy?
So if... You know, what is the ongoing slogan almost now that Ford is using, that we're an automotive and a mobility company, okay? So perhaps as we have more mobility vehicles that perhaps are not Ford vehicles, and as you've pointed out, if they're driving these things more often, they're going to need to be repaired and have oil changes and so on and so forth more often. And they're setting themselves up to say, hey, you know, you got a problem with, you know, your Uber? Bring it to us. We'll take care of it.
My question is the Motorcraft brand in the consumer's mind so closely tied to Ford that they couldn't have just expanded the Motorcraft brand if that's what they wanted to do?
You know, everything's about perception, right? And, you know, people's perceptions of dealerships are they're expensive. So unless my car is under warranty, I'm going to go look elsewhere. Some people take it to the dealer for anything, but most everybody else looks for an independent garage.
Right.
And if you start advertising, hey, it's Omnicraft and we can service anything, I think that starts to break down the perception. Whereas if you just said, hey, we can service your car too, people would go, no, you can't.
Yeah.
But if you say, but we've got Omnicraft, maybe you can change that perception.
I wonder if they're engineering them to the parts to the same standard and cost levels as they would a Motorcraft part.
At some point, they probably will, but then you got to figure that they've got more volume with Motorcraft, you know, right off the bat, so that'd be a problem. But so another thing Ford did this week, they hired a 34-year-old Musa Tariq as vice president and chief brand officer. Okay, and so he comes from Apple, where he had been the Apple's global marketing and communications director for retail. So what do you make of that?
Well, there's nothing sexier in the world of Detroit than if you can lure somebody away from a big tech company. They love that.
Right.
It gets you mentioned the mobility play. This is exactly right in that wheelhouse. It's expanding the brand to be more than just a new car provider. It's all these different services you're talking about, your connected cars, your car sharing, all these little adjacent businesses that they're going to try and put under this one big umbrella. And somebody like this that has experience with Apple, he was a social media guy.
Yeah, at Nike.
Burberry.
What's
like,
his first
and
job?
Nike.
Sell Omnicraft?
Yeah, he'd been the first ever social media director at Burberry. He was senior director of social media and community at Nike, and then he went to Apple.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he doesn't sound like a tech guy to me.
No, but it does sound like a customer experience guy. and a brand perception guy. And those are very valuable things these days.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Is Ford going to say, okay, man, come up with this new mobility brand for us? You know, I was jokingly saying, hey, your first assignment, Tariq, is,
right.
you know, go out and make sure that everybody knows Omnicraft. But I doubt they hired him to do that. I'm wondering, especially with him coming from Apple, is it about creating yet a new brand, a mobility brand? Or do they think, man, we got to polish up this thing called Ford and this thing called Lincoln?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the latter, initially. I mean, where the volume is now, they need to make the money, right? So I look at these two plays and I say to myself, you know what? Jack Nasser was right. Because, I mean, you know,
fit all over again.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, he looked at it from the point of view of we got to be much broader than just having people buy our cars and trucks. We need to service them. We need to, you know, we had the junkyards. We'll put them in the junkyards.
I was going to say, so scrapyarding is next.
There you go.
Yeah.
Back to the future.
Yeah. Just
maybe we'll get PAG back together. We'll start buying some smaller brands again.
You're exactly right. Yes.
You're losing your mind, Parker.
Getting the band back together.
Hey, I didn't do it the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought it was also interesting that they announced that they're going to have 20 new plug-in hybrid Ford Transit custom vans for London. And we've talked on the show a few times about the problems that in Europe that they're having with air quality. And apparently in London this past Monday, it was like off the charts.
Was it really?
The pollution was so bad.
Wow.
They were telling people to stay in the house and don't have kids go out, you know, at playtime from school and to stay in. And I'm thinking, well, that's sort of nice that they're going to be, you know, running this test, working with Transport for London. But then I thought, 20 vans? That's it? I mean,
are they all going to one, you know, one utility company or one business?
It sounds like blah 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 blah.
No,
no.
So it's a small initial test.
Yeah.
Well, you know, stick your toe in the water.
Yeah, I mean, you got to start somewhere, but
you know, learn from 20 and then take it up from there.
Right. But, you know, it just seems to me that the industry as a whole, I mean, needs to perhaps, you know, amp things up. I mean, when you have one of the leading, you know, cities in the world, you know, warning people don't go out because you can't breathe. You know, I mean, and I'm not talking about Beijing or places like that where we all know that this happens on a more regular basis. But, you know, in a Western country, that seems very strange.
Here's what I don't get about Europe. You know, there's this massive backlash against diesels. Oh, they're polluting and they're causing all this hazardous health and all this stuff. But in the U.S. right now, diesels have to meet the exact same emissions as gasoline engines. Why doesn't Europe just do that? I mean, I don't get it. And, you know, we've proved it can be done. We got pretty clean air here. I don't understand why the European industry is not more strongly defending diesels. In fact, if I were them, I'd get up and start demanding regulations that match what we've got in the U.S. and get this thing cleared up in a couple of years.
Well, clearly some regulatory work and enforcement needs to be done around diesel globally. I mean, we've all talked about Dieselgate till we're blue in the face, but I think people are looking at what's the next thing. We've already had these diesels for a long time, and yes, they're much, much cleaner than they used to be, but we're on the cusp of doing something, you know, remarkable with electrics or with fuel cells, and so they're just pushing off the next thing.
Yeah, I think that would just, I mean, if you're sitting in Wolfsburg and in a meeting, I think that the likelihood that you'd say, mein Herr, I would like to have a new diesel. You know, I mean, you would,
Dr. Professor.
Yeah,
That's not going to happen.
No.
But, you know, look, I'm all for electrics.
You'd be taking the train out of town.
I'm all for electrics and maybe even fuel cells and all that good stuff. But the reality is, even if we hit a tipping point in the next decade or something, it's going to take a long time to catch up to where we are with the piston engine right now in terms of what people actually have in their garage or out on the street. And it wouldn't take much of anything to say, yeah, whatever we're up to now, Tier 2, Bin 5, you know, make it so. Mm-hmm. Just start using the exact same standards that the U.S. has. And you'll get this thing. I mean, there's still stuff on the road that's going to take years to get off the road. But at least what's rolling off the line right now today would not be adding to the problem. It'd be the same as a gasoline engine. Mm. And I don't understand. I understand why Volkswagen's not going to get up there and defend diesels. But there are others in the industry who should be saying, wait a minute, we need an all of the above choice for consumers. And diesel should absolutely be part of that.
Well, John.
It's only me.
I don't disagree only with you, but we've got to get you into office, man.
From your, from your lips to Rudolph Diesel's ears. So speaking of electrics, I remember we had a lively discussion some months ago when there was the crash of the Tesla into the side of the semi-truck, and that mean, evil Elon Musk, how dare he put that technology in these vehicles, and this poor man.
Oh, there's a picture of the car. Look at that.
Wow.
So, and there's nothing left.
So NHTSA came out and cleared Tesla this week.
Yeah, they said there's no defect in the vehicle.
No defect, and NHTSA said in a report that Brown did not apply the brakes, and his last action was to set the cruise control at 74 miles per hour less than 2 minutes before the crash.
Yeah.
So
there's no defect in the vehicle, but I find it morbidly hilarious that the bloody car couldn't see that there was a semi across the road.
Right. The agency said the truck should have been visible to Brown for at least 7 seconds before the impact, and that he took no braking, steering, or other actions to avoid the collision. So basically, it comes down to operator error.
And I still believe, and I'm not an expert in this by any stretch of the imagination, that any normal adaptive cruise control would have caught that, because the Tesla system is relying primarily on cameras, is my understanding.
They don't like LiDAR.
And it could not, yeah, Tesla does not like LiDAR. And so you have a white semi-trailer background against a gray sky, and it can't distinguish it, and it sails the car right into it at 74 miles an hour. I believe damn near any other car with adaptive cruise control would have slammed on the brakes or advanced collision warning. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think NHTSA is doing here? I mean, do you think they're just trying to send the message that even with these cars that are getting to be semi-autonomous, that the driver is still ultimately responsible, and that's the message they're trying to send to the business?
At this point, I mean, I think that's absolutely the case. And, you know, but I mean, the thing of it is that, you know, even Tesla provides a warning that, you know, you must keep your hands on the wheel.
They do, but the duration of they've changed the duration of the warning, I think, and the frequency with which and the way that it behaves. And I still go back to the fact they called the damn thing autopilot.
Yeah.
They called it that. And remember, Elon Musk said you'll be able to drive from San Francisco to Seattle without doing anything.
It's talking out of this side of your mouth and talking out of that side
right.
of your mouth.
Right. So, you know, and my understanding is, and again, I haven't followed it that closely, is that the estate of the guy, the family of the guy that got killed, settled out of court with Tesla. I think they're very lucky, because even though NHTSA said there's no defect, I think you could argue that the company was misleading in, as to how you could use this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is significant that NHTSA said there's nothing wrong with the system.
Another thing that I thought when I was looking into Tesla this week, that, and maybe you guys knew about this, but I hadn't been aware of it, that they're now offering the Model S 100D that has a 335-mile range.
Yeah, they backed off on some of the performance from the P to get more range with this D.
So isn't that amazing?
It is.
335 miles on a charge?
Yeah. I mean, that's where we're going. I mean, the battery development has been, you know, really hockey sticked, I think, in the last few years. I think if we talked about this 5 years ago and said you'd get, you know, 160 miles out of anything, you'd be like, well, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, but look at how many more kilowatt hours of capacity they keep adding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you looked at the Chevy Volt with a V as in Victor, it was, what, a 30-kilowatt battery? No, not even that.
I was 18 or something?
Maybe 18. So the Bolt with a B as in boy is 60-kilowatt. If now here's the Tesla at 100-kilowatt, and if you look at Lucid Motors or Faraday Future, they're talking 130-kilowatt. Well, guess what? You know, that's about, what, $1,000 for each additional X number of kilowatt hours. So, yeah, you're getting the range, but the price is going up astronomically. Now, having said that, we do know that battery pack prices are coming down, and coming down faster than anyone thought they would.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the people that can afford a nice Model S, can probably do that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in a way that they're looking at what the competition is going to be doing, Faraday Future, if they can actually get a car to market, is, as you said, claiming a longer range and, you know, better acceleration and all that. So they have to kind of future-proof a little bit.
See, one of the things that I wonder about this is that, okay, so Tesla had already set the bar in terms of distance traveled by a vehicle. I mean, and if we think about it, you know, when the Leaf came out, what was it, 60-mile range or something like that?
I think it was higher than that, but the real world, like, but cold weather was about...
But, I mean, it was under 100.
Oh, yeah. I think EPA was, like, 76, 72, something like that, 72
and,
miles.
And, you know, and they've increased it, and, you know, and the i3 is sort of modest, and they've increased it. And here's this guy who, you know, already had the record, and now he just, like, goes this much higher. I mean, why are we not seeing Mercedes do this? Why are we not seeing Audi do this?
They don't have a fully electrified platform that's, you know, designed from scratch yet, that's on the market. I mean, you've got things like the B-Class EV from Mercedes, which is old tech, and it's just sort of sitting around.
It's an appliance car.
Right. And so they're working on that sort of stuff. And, you know, of course, the talk of range for their upcoming projects or Volkswagen's ID stuff and all that.
Right.
I suspect by the time it comes to market, they'll actually be over-delivering a little bit on range versus what they said they were. In the way that, you know, Chevy had a different target for the Bolt, and everybody likes to over-deliver and say, yeah, we got that much more.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised to see that with the Germans, too.
But you raise a good question there, Gary, because what it really does show is there is something to be said about this valley speed mentality. And Tesla's got that in spades. And, you know, Mercedes is still probably writing up the paperwork to present to the budget committee for next year's review, mm-hmm. and Tesla just does it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so they're reacting far more quickly than traditional automakers have. And I know all the issues with Tesla, they're not making money and blah, 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 burning through cash, but when it comes down to the basic engineering of what they're doing and how they're updating features, they're far faster than anybody else out there. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Yeah, and Elon started boring a tunnel to go from his SpaceX office to LAX this week.
On Twitter, yeah.
He will not be denied. And I thought it was very funny, the name. He's calling it The Boring Company.
Yeah.
Because there you
see what he did there.
Yeah, we'll be here all week.
We got distracted a moment. We got to take another quick break here. And Carmen, why don't we do that right now?
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
And we're back.
Elephant in the room, NAFTA.
Oh, yeah. Elephant in the room, Trump.
Yeah.
Two elephants in the room, NAFTA and Trump.
So what do you think, Chris?
And two elephants that don't get along with each other. You know, it'll be interesting because Trump has obviously said that he wants to renegotiate NAFTA and has already started to, you know, put the wheels in motion on that. But we've had some studies that have come out that say for the auto industry, that may not actually be the world's smartest thing. I think the Center for Automotive Research did a study that came out, like a week or two ago,
mm-hmm.
where they said you're actually looking at substantial job losses in the States. And it might not have the intended effect, especially on the supply chain.
Yeah, you know, Trump has said, I want to renegotiate NAFTA, but the little pieces that we've learned of maybe what they're talking about now is like judicial reconciliation features. Does it go to American courts? Does it go to some other court? So I'm not sure that we're going to see this 35% tariff, you know, rip the whole thing up. I think that the Canadians, Mexicans, and Americans could all probably agree, yeah, there are some things that we need to clean up here.
Right.
And if he just does that and declares victory, I think the industry's fine.
But what about the 35%? I mean, that hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't gone away, but, you know, Wilbur Ross is the Commerce Secretary. Wilbur Ross is a very successful businessman. Wilbur Ross owns companies that have, I believe, if I've got this right, six plants in Mexico. I don't think he's going to cut his own throat, even though supposedly he's divested himself of all that. I don't think he wants to go and kill the guys that he was just running the operations for. So, I know somebody who knows Trump very well, was invited to the Trump New Year's Eve party at Mar-a-Lago. And when I asked him, what the hell are you going to do? You've got these plants in Mexico yourself. He said, John, look, there's other adults in the room, and they're not going to let them do anything stupid. Mm-hmm. I hope that's the case. And maybe that's what's going to happen. That's certainly what the old guard is expecting to have happen. I mean, old guard Republicans, that we've got some smart people on the cabinet, and they're not going to let this president go off the deep end. I don't know what's going to happen.
But the old guard Republicans thought Jeb Bush would be the president. So I think we got. Okay. So let me ask you guys this question. So we were talking about diesels and we were talking about electric vehicles. And now another part of this, when Sergio and Mary and Mark went to the White House for breakfast the other day, I mean, the issue of, you know, we're going to cut these environmental regulations. You know, all these are just crazy. So is this bringing back diesel and nailing the coffin shut?
Let's see what he means,
because,
you know, the people I've talked to in the car companies say, yeah, we'd like a little bit of relief. Don't get rid of these regulations. I won't name who. I'll just say a very, very, very senior level executive at General Motors said, don't change it. The plans are in place.
Right.
This executive believes General Motors is going to have a competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. And I got to believe the people at Ford are thinking the same thing. We've got our plans and we've got an advantage. And, you know, I've said all along, these are scientifically based standards. They're not some flaky pie in the sky, pull a number out of nowhere. So instead of making it 2025 for CAFE, make it 2030. That would give the industry a design cycle. I think it would be huge, and you still get to the same results anyway.
Mm-hmm. And you give Trump a little bit of a victory saying, you know, we've loosened the restrictions here so that we have this pro-business administration, and you get that sort of victory. And obviously, automakers have to, develop their vehicles to global standards anyway. And so if we relax our standards nationally, that doesn't mean, A, that California and compliant states are going to do that, and B, that the international other major markets are going to do the same thing. It's completely unlikely that they will. So they still have to, you know, develop for those markets anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a war coming with California Air Resources Board. There's no question about that in my mind. But you raise a really good point, Chris, that the rest of the world's not going to back off. And so if we back off in the U.S. and the domestic automakers don't have this economy of scale that they're going to need in other markets for all these emissions and fuel economy benefits, you're actually making them less competitive on the global stage. You're right. Taking away scale from them.
So, but one might make the argument that if we're only worried about a portion of this continent, who cares about the rest of the world, right? All right. So, let me ask you. Okay. Another aspect of this was that he said that he wanted more plants built here. Now, what do you think the likelihood, John? And I know your answer is going to be to this one, that there will be new plants built in the United States to build automobiles.
Zero. Now, let me add. You know, it's a couple of asterisks. Yeah, maybe a Lucid, maybe a Faraday, maybe other startups.
Right, but I'm.
Probably Hyundai, Kia, they probably need more capacity. Maybe they'd consider putting a plant here. But for GM, Ford, or FCA to build a new plant, not in our lifetimes. That's how I see it. For two reasons. You know, number one is, remember, they closed like 19 assembly plants because of the Great Recession. They took out millions of units of capacity. It is the single greatest reason why they're so profitable today. They don't want to add more capacity, especially at a sales peak. And as you talk about all this mobility, share this, share that, ride sharing, car sharing, maybe we don't need more cars in the future. Now, some argue maybe we do. But until there's a clear path, I'm not going to build a new plant. In fact, I'm sort of wondering why Ford ever even thought it needed a new plant in Mexico.
I don't disagree with you. I think that's spot on. I think, you know, you may see a couple of small southern plants from, you know, a Volvo or something like that, or a startup, Lincoln Company or whatever. But the domestics, there's no chance. And they don't want it. And I'd like to believe that if our new president is as intelligent as he says that he is, that he will listen to the people in the room and realize that it's actually not a pro-business move to start developing new factories, that the automakers don't want them.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was an interesting comment on our Autoline Daily thing from somebody who clearly supports Trump. And he said, I don't care if we don't get new plants. But if they add capacity here, you know, they add some more jobs, I'm happy. So I think that's where Trump's going to declare victory. You know, a Ford saying, you know, we're putting $700 million into Flat Rock, we're going to build cars there. A General Motors saying we're going to insource some stuff from Mexico for axles, for trucks. And if others say, yeah, we broke a bottleneck here, we added a few jobs there, I think the base is going to be completely happy and they're going to give Trump all the credit for it.
Yeah, I think no one doesn't want more jobs. And
no, of course.
I mean, it's a good thing, but it just seems if the NAFTA gets torn up, I think that we're going to find ourselves with more unemployed rather than employed. And if we have more new plants, that the new plants will be so highly automated that the number of workers will be infinitesimal.
Well, that's really the thing. I mean, automation has really been the driving force as to, you know, removing manufacturing jobs.
Yeah,
it hasn't been moving overseas. It's been automation.
Right.
But you can't win an election on that.
No, absolutely not.
I think some of the automation stuff is overblown. I really do. I mean, it still takes thousands of people to make cars in an assembly plant.
No. So I read this thing while I was looking into this, that I discovered this guy, there was a story in Fast Company about a Jonathan Zostro, former Seattle software developer, and he began to think about automating the manufacture of clothing. Okay, now clothing has gone more out of this country than anything else. I mean, according to the American Apparel and Footwear Association, domestic apparel manufacturing fell from 50% in 1994 to roughly 3% in 2015. So this guy came up with a way that what you'd take the cloth and you'd dip it into polymer that would make it sufficiently stiff enough mm-hmm. so a robot can actually go in and sew these
wow.
things. And then you dip it in water and voila. You're ready to go. So I'm thinking if some software developer...
Polyester, baby. We're back to leisure suits.
If this guy can come up with a way to do this, I'm thinking automation is going to have a big effect on any new automobile factories.
It could. Look, automation's been a long-going, ongoing, you know, trend in the industry. But when you look in the automotive industry, you know, for example, I think I got these numbers right. In 1965... General Motors had 500,000 hourly workers. Today, in the United States, today it has 50,000, and they probably build the same number of vehicles. But the great reduction was in the massive amount of outsourcing. You know, probably more than half those employees who are what turned out to be Delphi and got spun out. And so, you know, a lot of people cite these big figures. Look at the big drop-off, and it's all automation. It's not all automation. Yes, there's more robots. They haven't displaced nearly as many jobs as being bantied about in the popular press right now by people who, I'll bet $1 million, have never stepped into a factory in their lives.
That I believe.
And what else do we have in here?
One more thing, then we got to wrap up.
All right, okay, so I thought this was absolutely apropos of approximately nothing, but we talked a little bit about autonomous vehicles. And I didn't know this, that China is now in the process of building the world's largest experimental zone for autonomous driving. It will cover it's in a 65 square kilometer zone in a section of a city, okay? They'll have a 443-acre closed testing ground and a 494.2-acre open experimental field. Okay, now these numbers mean absolutely nothing to anyone, right? Now, M City, which is in Ann Arbor, is working with the Chinese on developing this. M City has 16 acres of roads and is on 32 acres.
M City's very small.
So it's like nothing.
Yeah, but that's M City, and that's part of the University of Michigan. Then there's the American Center for Mobility, which is much larger.
But it isn't open yet, right?
No.
No.
It opens the end of this year, if things go according to schedule. But does just because you have a big test facility size-wise mean that you're better or ahead? I don't think so. Now, having said that, I think China might be the first to adopt autonomous technology because necessity is the mother of invention. They have the worst traffic and the worst pollution, and this can help alleviate it. So they need autonomy, arguably, more than any other country in the world, certainly more than the U.S. does. But I'm not convinced that just because you have a bigger test track, you've got a better product.
And, you know, they've got all those big empty cities that they just built that are just sitting there. Why don't they
just use one of those?
just annex one of those.
Yeah. Maybe they have and they just not. But, I mean, I find it interesting, though, that here they're, you know, that they're saying, okay, this is something sufficiently compelling for us to create this vast thing rather than saying, you know, we'll have this small thing over in the corner over there and we'll test some cars.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we're going to need more facilities like that in the States. We're already seeing it. The Willow Run project we just mentioned and out in California, people are expanding their efforts up there, too, and I think you'll see more and more of that.
I got a press release yesterday from Texas making an indication that, you know, Texas has got, like, autonomous testing everywhere in the entire state, you know.
No, I love it. I love the fact that all of a sudden, and this has only happened in the last year or two, all these tech companies want to be part of the auto industry. All these states want to be part of the auto industry. You know, it's like, for me, it's very refreshing to see. Mm-hmm. After having, for so many decades, people just disparage the industry and think, you're just a bunch of Midwest rubes that don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody wants to be part of it. It's exciting again.
The Rust Belt is all shiny.
It's getting shinier all the time. And all of a sudden now there are young people who are going, wow, I want to join the auto industry and change the world. I'm telling you, 24 months ago, we never heard anyone talking about that. I love what's happening.
34-year-old guy from Apple, right?
Yeah. Right.
Putting a dent in the universe here.
Right. Good stuff. Well, look, we got to wrap this up at some point. Let's wrap it up now. But Chris Pockert, CNET, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you, Chris.
Gary, good seeing you.
Okay.
We'll do it again next week.
All right.
Okay.
Great.
Of course, got to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.